From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. A Janesville writer takes on gender expectations in her new book, Redefining Girly, and hopes we can avoid the sexualization and stereotyping of girls. She says the fight must start at home.
What lessons do you want your child to learn? Because every parent knows kids soak up everything around them.
Then a botanist walks into a bar and comes away with the idea for a book on the long history of using plants and alcoholic beverages, starting with gin.
It is nothing but a bottle full of distilled plants, and really diverse and interesting plants. I mean, not just the grains that the alcohol is made out of.
Essayist and violin maker Corinthia Klein mourns the theft of the Lipinski Stradivarius, and we'll have the second episode of our new series, The Islands of Milwaukee. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. More than 40 years ago, the album Free to Be, You and Me tried to get children and their parents to think differently about gender roles that had been traditionally assigned to boys and girls, men and women. In the past four decades, women have outnumbered men in higher education. They've become astronauts, have unprecedented opportunities in business and in sports. And so it would seem that our culture has come a long way in how we view women and girls. But has it really? Janesville writer Melissa Atkins-Wardy argues that girls in 2014 are dealing with societal expectations their parents and grandparents probably never imagined. Her new book is called Redefining Girly: How Parents Can Fight the Stereotyping and Sexualizing of Girlhood from Birth to Tween. It's basically a how-to, or a how-not-to, guide for helping parents navigate the current state of gender expectations in this country. Atkins-Wardy talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about why there's such concern about what we're teaching our kids about gender.
Well, I think as far as we've come, we've moved backwards. So we have made great strides. You know, there are women breaking the glass ceiling, entering into careers like the NFL referee that you mentioned, where a woman has never worked before. And those are tremendous things. At the same time, when you look at girlhood, the only thing we're marketing to them are the lowest common denominators of femininity. And our girls are growing up with that idea that that's what it means to be female, unless parents are offering them other resources and other mentors and people to look up to. So, you know, it's tricky because you would think that, I mean, certainly I grew up in the 80s. And so I thought that raising my children at this time would be, we would be past all of that. And I think our culture is just as sexist as it's ever been.
Well, would you argue that the messages about gender are different today than they once were? Are they more insidious? I guess marketing has come a long way, just as
right.
Everything else has come a long way.
Right. So the messages about gender really aren't different. That has stayed the same. It's that the marketing is omnipresent, and marketers can now market directly to children. Like when you and I were growing up, we didn't have that. When marketing was deregulated in the 1980s, marketers, it was open season for kids, and kids became a consumer group.
So how much of this do you think, maybe we're jumping way forward in the message, how much of this do you think is basically about raising kids with better critical thinking skills?
I think that's a huge part of it because you can't block out culture and you're never going to be able to block out marketing, certainly not in the United States. So you need to have your kids being raised with those skills because you can't keep them in a bubble and you can't protect them. And what you have to do is instill your family values to them so that when these cultural messages come in, the kids use that as a benchmark and the messages either stick and stay or the kids weigh them and let pieces bounce off or stay in. And that way they're questioning what they're seeing instead of just taking it all in and having that be what's teaching them.
Well, let's talk specifically about some of those messages. And maybe a good place to start is when you first started to become aware of the messages that we're sending kids and their parents really about gender.
So when I became a parent, I didn't know any of none of this was on my radar. And I had a daughter in 2006, and she was named after Amelia Earhart. And so I was looking for a onesie with a girl pilot on it. They didn't make those. It was princesses, ballet, cupcake, you know, tiaras. That was it. Or these messages about being like a sassy diva, which to me just seemed like, why would I want my little girl to act that way? So I kind of became aware of it then, and I talked with my mom. She recommended some books, and I got into reading, and 6 months later, we were shopping for her first sippy cup. And I was in the aisles at Target, and there was a big row of pink princess cups and then blue cups that I think might have had the Toy Story characters on it, but that was it. Like, there were no cups that just had random childhood pictures on it, you know, sort of gender-inclusive colors. It was just pink or blue. And it just seemed odd to me. And then when we went over to the toy aisle, it was three rows of pink and three rows of blue. And that was my aha moment. Like, this is very, like, it's just sort of gender segregation. And I didn't think it would be like this for my daughter. And then you looked at the messages for girls. It was princess, fashion and beauty, or domestic cleaning. And for boys, it was everything else in the world. And I thought, well, wait a minute. I want my daughter to play sports and build things and do science and like dinosaurs. Like, those aren't boy things. Those are kid things.
Well, and if it were only about things like clothes and toys, it would be significant enough. But you go on to write that these messages seemed like they were being reinforced by people that you might not expect to be reinforcing them.
No, yeah. I think my daughter was about 13 or 14 months old when we were at the pediatrician. And she'd been very – I think it was for ear infection. She'd been well-behaved during the appointment. And so he handed her a dinosaur as a reward. And it was green. And it touched her hands and her face lit up and she was so excited. And he immediately took it back and said, oh, no, no, you'll want the pink one. And I'm like, she doesn't even know her colors yet. Like, she certainly doesn't know her gender stereotype. So let her have the green dinosaur.
At what point do you think – kids are – I mean, obviously, you know, when your daughter wasn't old enough to know her colors, you weren't having these kinds of conversations with her. It was essentially about modeling behavior. But at what point do you think kids are old enough to start understanding the message that you're trying to instill in them and having explicit conversations about the choices that they make?
Yeah. So definitely with, you know, both of our kids, they're 8 and 5. We started doing this from the beginning. And it is about modeling and making sure that the clothing and the toys in home are, you know, rainbow of colors, all themes to build the best, you know, cognitive development and milestones for kids. So I think as far as conversations, we started about 2 when she started watching TV. And we'd be watching Wonder Pets, and which is a great show because you can't actually tell the gender of the 3 characters. And I know you're singing the song in your head right now.
I will say we actually managed to avoid Wonder Pets around our household only because it drove my wife crazy.
And so we would talk about that and, you know, Ming Ming or, you know, we would say to Amelia, my daughter, we'd be like, oh, do you think she was very brave while she was saving the baby skunk or whatever? And just kind of getting her thinking about things like that, teaching her that she can interact with her media, that, you know, the messages that come from media aren't verbatim, that it's – we can question those things. And as she got older, it was things like, oh, you know, there's a bunch of boys on TV, but the girl on the side is being quiet. Like, she's not offering her ideas or she's not involved in the rescue. Like, don't you think she could be the hero? And just getting them questions like that, just talking about things when we would see them.
There's a balancing act as kids get older, I would imagine, though, about when you start to talk about the appropriateness of consumer products and messages without wanting to inadvertently make sexualization seem appealing or you know, simply making your kids feel bad.
Right, or introducing them to concepts that they aren't really aware of yet. And that, you know, and that's the trick. And so some of the parenting adage that bigger kids, bigger problems. You just want to give it an age appropriate doses. So you could say to them, I mean, instead of going on this long trajectory of the sexualization, objectification of women and how that plays into the, you know, patriarchal bargain of, and your 5-year-old's gonna be looking at you like, what? I just wanted fruit snacks. So, you know, break it down and say, you know, that doll, her outfit's kind of skimpy and small and it seems really tight. Like, do you think she can run around on the playground dress like that? And her shoes seem really high and like she might be teetering back and forth. Like, would she be able to run fast? And that's going to compute for a 5-year-old because that's what 5-year-olds do with their day. So put it into language that they understand and then you just continue to grow that message as your child grows.
You know, I'm sure there are probably people who are listening and thinking about this and they think, well, I had Barbies when I was a kid, you know, or I had dolls when I was a kid. And, you know, I turned out okay. I think I have the right attitude about gender roles. Is there something different about Barbies today and other dolls versus the way they always have been? I mean, you know, there were Barbies doing fairly unrealistic things as far back as the 60s and 70s.
Right. There were – well, and ironically, those unrealistic things in the 60s were groundbreaking things like being a female astronaut. So – Barbie then, I think, was actually groundbreaking and was probably a really interesting cultural phenomenon. But today she's different because, again, they can market directly to children, and all marketers compress adulthood into childhood. And it's actually a term called kids getting older, younger. So Barbie is a little different. You know, I played with Barbie growing up. Clearly, I grew up to be okay. I mean, I've just written this book about the topic. And my daughter has Barbies, but she has mermaid Barbies, so that we're focused on what they do as opposed to what they look like. And there's a lot of Barbies. You know, I mean, the brand is huge, so there's several different versions of the doll. But a couple of them just focus on fashion and beauty and dressed in a way that would be appropriate if you're going clubbing in Miami, but maybe not for your six-year-old. I don't agree with banning anything from the home. So if you're going to have Barbie in the house, just be prepared to have some conversations with your child and pick Barbies that are, you know, maybe Barbie president or Barbie teacher as opposed to Miss Sassy Barbie that I should have brought with me. I have her. But, you know, she looks like she could possibly be a sex worker. So it's what lessons do you want your child to learn? Because every parent knows kids soak up everything around them. And an example that I use is for families who take their kids to church when they're young, certainly kids don't understand religion and all of its components, but you take it there so they soak it in so they have a foundation. Well, it's the same thing for toys and media. Kids maybe not wouldn't recognize or be able to call out sexualization when they see it, but they're certainly soaking those messages in. And the research, all the empirical research behind this backs that up. And so parents just really need to be aware of it.
But having your kids on board with your own philosophy, it seems like only one part of the equation. How do you start to reverse engineer all the factors around you, whether it's the other parents that are throwing birthday parties for their kids, or it's the messages they're hearing from their teachers in school or their friends in school?
Yeah, you know, it's tricky because we run into all those with my family and the people in the Pigtail Pals and Ballcat Buddies community on our Facebook page. We talk about this stuff all of the time, and it can be tricky. I think what I encourage the parents to do is speaking your truth. So just like you would say, I'm so sorry, my son has a nut allergy, we can't eat that. Or, you know, thank you for taking the time, but whatever. You have to just stick up for your children. And it's about health, right? These aren't just opinions or views. This is actually, you know, the sexualization and this body image stuff physically and emotionally hurts our kids. And so it's about speaking up for their health, just like you would if it were a food allergy or some other thing.
These are difficult conversations to have with some people, mm-hmm. however, because, you know, the difference here is if you talk about, you know, your child's nut allergy or whatever, it doesn't come off as a matter of opinion, whereas you have a conversation with another parent about your own parenting style, it could easily become a question of, you know, what we value versus what you value.
Yeah, it can come off as judgmental, and you certainly don't want it to be. And I try to teach my community just to act with grace. And not everybody is going to have the level of understanding with media literacy that people would maybe after they've read my book or my blog and my colleagues' work for a long period of time. So I encourage people to meet other people where they're at. So you might be able to say, thank you so much for that birthday gift. We feel that doll is a little grown up for Avery or Rebecca. And so we appreciate the time that you spent with her. And she's actually really into finger painting right now. So we're going to, you know, and kind of replace what you don't like with something positive. And again, focus on the relationship that person has with your child as opposed to what they did, because we're not judged for our actions. We're judged by who we are, and kind of focus it that way. And at the end of the day, if the person gets mad at you, that's really none of your business. Your job is to raise your child.
You also argue for becoming the media you want to see.
Yeah.
What are you getting at in that regard?
So this one's huge. And for boys and girls, is that media surrounds our kids. It's like telling a fish not to notice the water. It's just everywhere. So you can teach your children to be the voice that you would want them to hear, so they can create plays and they can make up their own cartoons. I remember when I was little, we used to have this tape recorder and we would pretend that we were newscasters. Like, I think it was on Nickelodeon. It was not necessarily the news. And we would make these ridiculous, almost like Saturday Night Live type newscasts. And it was just about knowing that your voice matters or that your opinions matter. So whether it's, you know, whatever medium, whether it's pretending to be a radio host or a television reporter or a cinematographer, make your kids the media so they can have an old digital camera, a sketch pad, an old recording device to, you know, interview every adult they see. So getting them to understand that all of this content is created just by regular people, so that the movie they saw or the cartoon they're watching isn't this sort of amazing supernatural thing. It's just drawn by a bunch of men and women sitting at desks, and that's their job. And kind of peeling back those layers so that it becomes a little less mystical for them.
You mentioned that this is not just a message for girls. It's a message for boys. And really, as I read Redefining Girly, you know, the light bulb goes off, and this is – ostensibly a book about kind of reclaiming girlhood, but it's also just as much about boyhood.
It is. It so is. I mean, and, you know, like we talked, we both have a girl and boy in our families that we're raising. And so obviously the brother-sister relationship is impacted, but so it is with when they're at school and they need peers and they need cross-gender friendships are really important, especially in early childhood, because it helps you understand everybody as you grow older instead of keeping people as two separate, you know, groups. Like the kids need to be intermingling. And what I tell my community is that when you spend a coin, you don't spend one side of it, you spend both sides of it. So what affects girls affects boys and vice versa. And you know, I hear a lot of parents of boys say, oh, thank God I don't have girls. But I look at them and I'm like, who do you think your sons are going to marry? Or who do you think is going to grow up to be your grandchild's teacher? Or these girls that we're not expecting much from, that we're raising pretty much to be real housewives, what are we missing out on as far as a country that they could be amazing scientists and political leaders or titans in business? And we're only encouraging that from one half of the population.
Well, Melissa Atkins-Wardy, thank you so much for sharing this story with us, and best of luck to you.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Melissa Atkins-Wardy is a writer who lives in Janesville. Her new book is called Redefining Girly, How Parents Can Fight the Stereotyping and Sexualizing of Girlhood from Birth to Tween. It's published by the Chicago Review Press. She's also the owner of a clothes and accessories company called Pigtail Pals and Ball Cap Buddies. Atkins-Wardy will talk about the book Wednesday evening at the Linden Sculpture Garden in a Boswell Book Company event. There is more information at wuwm.com/lake effect. And there is also more information there about our winter membership drive, which is in its third day. And I'm joined by Lake Effect producer and technical director Dan Harmon. Hi, Dan.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. And it is a good morning. We are on our way to raise $650 for this hour, and we can do that.
I think we can. And since we're talking about numbers,
let's talk about money.
We have this whole list of numbers right in front of me, and I just want to give people an idea of some of the costs involved in running the station. I'll just give you some, bear with me because numbers are always so dry. But the budget for the station for the entire year, $3,779,507. That was the budget from last year. So that's quite a bit to keep this place running. And that equates to $314,000 per month, $72,000 per week, $10,000 per day, basically $431 per hour. That's, we're getting there with what we're trying to raise this hour.
Right. We'd be a little bit more, actually, if we got that $650.
Right. And then programming services is 58% of our budget. So just one more stat there.
Just one more stat. And it's important to kind of let you know that because we're not raising money just for the heck of it. We actually do need the money to bring you the programming that you love, to bring you interviews like what we just heard from Melissa Atkins-Wardy about the stereotyping of girls. It's about the interview that's coming up with Amy Stewart about the drunken botanist and how your, you know, all of the alcohol that you may drink, it comes from plants and where that, you know, that there's this whole botanical basis for this. We run the gamut here on Lake Effect, and that is one of the things that we hope that you take to heart and call 414-227-3210. That is 414-227-3210. You can also go online, Dan, to
our website, wuwm.com. That's wuwm.com. Or if you want to be more specific, wuwm.com/give. And just in case you want another stat, I can't imagine why you wouldn't. We don't really have an hourly number for Lake Effect at the ready, but if you just want an idea of the cost of some programs, Morning Edition is $362 per hour. That's how much we pay, or the station pays, out of our budget for Morning Edition. And then All Things Considered is $218 per hour. These things aren't cheap, so that's why we look to our listeners to help contribute.
As we're saying, this is the theme of the membership drive this time, and that is be part of the equation. And the way you can be part of the equation is by calling 414-227-3210 or go to wuwm.com/give. Well, we talked about The Drunken Botanist. A botanist does walk into a bar, and the book that she ends up writing traces the uses of plants in making alcoholic drinks. From sugarcane to saffron, we'll travel the world with A Drunken Botanist next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The next time a bartender asks you what you're having, you could say you're in the mood for that heady combination of juniper, grains of paradise, wormwood, and olive. Or maybe on second thought, perhaps you'd rather sip on that mix of barley, oak, marasca cherry, and yellow gentian. Well, of course, you could be kind and just order a martini or a Manhattan. But writer Amy Stewart wants you to know the plants that make up your alcoholic drink of choice. Stewart's highly entertaining book, The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks, traces the botanical history and the chemistry of the various plants that line the shelves of every well-stocked bar and offers recipes and suggestions for new combinations. From the common to the obscure, the book is an, well, intoxicating read. Stewart was in Milwaukee last spring to speak and to sign books at the Great Lakes Distillery. We caught up with her in Chicago, and she joined us on the line. Amy, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Drunken Botanist. Why this book? It's a wonderful book, but what possessed you to decide to go this route?
Well, you know, this was actually one of those ideas that started in a bar, believe it or not. So I was sitting around with a friend of mine who is also a horticulture writer and a landscape designer, and we were actually talking about gin, and he was saying, oh, yeah, I've never been much of a gin drinker. And I said, how can you not be interested in gin? Because if you think about it, it is nothing but a bottle full of distilled plants, and really diverse and interesting plants. I mean, not just the grains that the alcohol is made out of, but also the citrus and the juniper berries and cardamom, and I mean all these interesting herbs and spices from really around the world. And we're sitting in this bar and I'm looking at all the bottles and saying, you know what, come to think of it, there's nothing but distilled plant matter in all of these bottles. Like, isn't that interesting? So I think at some point that night I said, you know, somebody ought to write a book about that.
And here we are with The Drunken Botanist.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
The plants that create the world's great drinks. And they do. And they're the odd plants, unusual plants, and also common plants. I mean, things that you might not think of that actually go into some very common alcoholic drinks.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I wanted to start with the plants that we actually ferment and distill and make into alcohol. And really, even that just beginning point is pretty broad, because anything that has starch or sugar in it has probably been fermented and distilled somewhere around the world at some point. But obviously, you know, the usual suspects would be things like grapes and apples and corn and barley. So rice, you know, all of those plants were really my stepping off point for this.
And then you talk about, you mentioned it before, the things that flavor the alcohol, things that don't necessarily become alcohol themselves, but like juniper berries and gin, for example, that gives it that very distinct gin flavor.
Right, yeah. And that's really kind of part two. So, you know, the next thing that happens is that at the distillery, a distiller will add more plants to change the flavor. And, you know, that's, you think about beer and hops. I mean, I hear people say beer is made from hops. Well, it's not made from hops. It's flavored with hops. So, you know, that's just one of many plants that get added during the bottling phase to alter the flavor. And there are many very weird and unusual plants that get used, because this is part of, you know, really our ancient history going back to, you know, how we were making medicines hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Well, what are some of the most unusual plants that you came across that are turned into some sort of alcoholic drink?
Well, you know, some of the really odd ones around the world that people might not think of, one of my favorite ones is the monkey puzzle tree, which which is a very strange-looking conifer from Chile and Argentina that grows up the West Coast and is sort of a specimen tree and maybe even a conservatory, you know, greenhouse-type tree in some places around the world. And the monkey puzzle tree produces these nuts, and in its native region in Chile, native people will actually chew the nuts and use the digestive the enzymes in their saliva to help break down the sugars and start the fermentation process. So the way you make it is to actually chew and spit into a shared tub these monkey puzzle nuts, and then that makes this sort of a low alcohol, almost like a homemade beer called Mudai.
I don't know that I'd want to drink it.
I don't think it's going to catch on anytime soon. But, you know, it shows you the lengths that people will go to have a drink, right?
Exactly. And that's the thing that's just fascinated me about this book, is that as human beings, we have spent an inordinate amount of time distilling things, fermenting things, trying to alter our reality with liquid.
Well, yeah. And you know, it's sort of laughable in a way. You kind of think, like, really, didn't we have more important things to do than just try to figure out a way to make a drink? But you know what? I mean, there really were some health reasons for it originally. Water was not always safe to drink. And, you know, certainly, you know, you think about Europeans coming to the Americas for the first time. You know, they were used to the water in the Thames, for instance, which was by no means safe to drink. And even sort of before the rise of big civilizations, you know, if an animal dies and falls in the river, you can't drink the water in that river. So a mildly fermented beverage was, in a way, kind of a health drink, because even a little bit of alcohol could kill off bacteria before we even knew what bacteria was. So there were some good reasons for it.
Well, the other thing you do in this book, I mean, you also have recipes, which is wonderful for all kinds of different things, but you give some, as we've been alluding to, basic history of the plants themselves. And one of the ones that I found most fascinating was the sugarcane story.
Yeah, sugarcane, you know, which is really nothing but a big overgrown grass, if you think about it. But it's kind of an amazing plant, because if you picture sugarcane, you know how it has those little nodes in between each segment, those little sort of joints?
Yes.
Each one of those holds root tissue and leaf tissue, and of course there's enough sugar in the stalk to feed a young plant. So every one of those little nodes has everything inside of it to make a new plant. So it's really a survivor. But, you know, Christopher Columbus brought sugarcane to the Caribbean, so we may think of it as a Caribbean plant or even a Latin American plant, but that's very new. I mean, that was Europeans bringing it. But it's a real survivor, you know. I mean, it does well in tropical areas around the world and is so easy to replant and grow that it's no wonder Europeans took it with them everywhere they went.
Yeah, I think in the book you say that the first recorded use of it is about 6,000 B.C.
Right, yeah. And, you know, this is one of the really interesting things that I found, is that there are archaeologists and sort of ethnobotanists doing really interesting research into, you know, what was our first use of some of these plants. And it really does go back a long way. We can look at ancient cave paintings and really early writings and even analyze the residue on shards of pottery at archaeological digs to see the earliest use of these plants in fermentation and distillation.
All of this we're talking about is history. What about going forward now? Are people, and I don't even know what to call them, people who are coming up with new ways of combining plants into alcoholic drinks, are people exploring new and different ways, or have we pretty much exhausted the combinations?
Oh, no, I don't think we're anywhere near exhausting the combinations. You know, it's nice to see, especially here in the United States, we've had this real revival of craft distilleries, including, you know, throughout the Midwest, there are people making interesting whiskeys and, you know, of course, a great beer-making tradition that's continuing. But even other types of plants that you might not have thought of. So, for instance, sorghum is the fourth largest food crop in the United States after corn, wheat, and soybeans. And there's a guy in Indiana making a wonderful rum out of sorghum molasses that he gets from an Amish farmer. So a very American spirit. and really exciting to see. So I think actually we're in sort of a new age of exploration where distillers are really looking around the world for new and interesting flavors to try, and it's also a great way for distillers to work with farmers to use up some of their surplus produce. And this was originally what beer making and liquor making was really all about. It's the, you know, the potatoes or the apples that are the wrong size or a little bit blemished or otherwise unsaleable can easily be fermented and distilled and made into a product that can be sold. So it's a nice way to work with farmers as well.
I wasn't thinking about this until you just mentioned this about people moving forward and thinking about different flavors. Do you think that the lack of seed diversity and possibly plant diversity might have an effect with this, or do you think that that's not really an issue?
No, actually, it is an issue. I was really surprised when I was looking at corn, for example. I assumed that there would be bourbon distillers out there working with very unusual heirloom corn varieties. But, you know, it turned out that a lot of the people making bourbon were, they just wanted corn. You know, they were just like, we just want, you know, number two yellow field corn that's got plenty of starch in it and is easy to work with. So it took some effort to really find somebody who was looking at heirloom varieties of corn. And I did find some. For instance, I found a grower in New York State, Tulletown Spirits, is doing they're doing whiskey with Wapsie Valley corn, which is a Minnesota heirloom corn that's red. And he says you can really taste a different flavor when you use these heirloom corn varieties.
Well, I would imagine you could, you know, depending on, that's the whole point of adding the flavors to the various alcohols, is to get something that's very specific and unique.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. I mean, you know, first of all, just making the alcohol itself, it can depend on what variety of plant you use and what kind of still. Also, what strain of yeast you use to ferment it. For instance, I talked to an apple expert, a pomologist, that's the word I was looking for, who took the same variety of apple and fermented it with different strains of yeast and got very different flavors just because of the yeast that was used. So there are a lot of different, you know, variables that go into how it ends up, you know, tasting once it's in the bottle.
Well, as a botanist and someone who obviously enjoys a drink now and then, what do you hope that non-botanists and non-distillers or brewers take away from your book?
Well, you know, I really want people to be interested in where their ingredients come from and where, you know, what's in the glass comes from. So I think that if you're a gardener, you're probably looking around at your garden seeing all kinds of new possibilities, you know, for a cocktail party that you might not have considered before. And if you're interested in cocktails, I think that just knowing this history and knowing a little bit about the ingredients and what they are can actually help you make a better drink. You know, I travel around and give talks to bartenders where I talk about, here are some other plants that are in the same plant family as the one that you're mixing drinks with. So you'll get some compatible flavors by using related plants. So that's just a little tiny bit of botany that can help explain why certain things work in the glass or don't.
Unfortunately, I don't think the knowledge protects you from the after effects of the alcohol, however.
No, it does not. You know, it's so funny that you bring that up because my publisher asked me to include recipes for hangover remedies in the back of the book. And I said, you know, I hate to tell you this, but there's only one cure for a hangover, and that is to not drink too much in the first place.
Time, I was going to say, probably let it work through your system.
It's just time. It's, you know, it's water and time. And yeah, that's just it. I mean, let's face it, alcohol is a poison. If you drink too much of it, it actually could kill you. So, you know, you're putting a burden on your liver, and it processes things in a certain order. And often it takes the most difficult and nasty things you feed it, and it does those last. And so that's why you wake up the next morning and you're still feeling terrible, because your liver is saying to you, you know, if I have to clean up your mess, you're going to suffer right along with me. Here we go.
So, as you say, the best cure is to not have too much.
That's right. The best and only.
Well, when you, when you're here in Milwaukee, I know you're giving a talk at the distillery here. Do you get these kinds of questions, or are there more specific questions that you get when people come to these events?
Well, you know, what I try to do, if we're serving drinks at the event, which we often are, as it turns out, What I try to do is to talk about the plants that are in the drinks that people have in their hand, which is fun because it means it's a little different for me every time. But also, you know, I mean, making it really specific to what people are actually tasting and looking at. But usually people have some drink that they have burning questions about. So I try to answer those. Some people want to know about absinthe, or they want to know about, you know, tequila or something they drank in college one time and can't quite remember the name of. So it's very interesting the sorts of burning questions people are walking around with about what exactly is in that.
But for you, do you have a favorite? A favorite plant flavor or a favorite drink?
Well, let's see. I will tell you about one that I really love and that is always on the shelf at my house, and it is Liquore Strega. So Strega means witch in Italian. And this is a yellow herbal liqueur that is so hard to describe. It's one of those secret recipes. You know, a lot of these European distillers, they don't like to tell you what's in their secret mm-hmm. formula. But Angelica is widely believed to be one of the flavors, which is a really bright, sweet, almost minty flavor. Angelica is really lovely. But anyway, Strega is this wonderful, very complex, spicy and herbal liqueur that is amazing after dinner. I pour it for people just a little tiny bit in a glass with an ice cube and just watch their eyes open wide. It just sort of warms you all the way through, and it's a wonderful little after-dinner drink.
I'll have to try it. I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, I know. It's fantastic, and people don't know about it, so I'm trying to change that.
Okay, well, hopefully this will help.
Exactly.
So, well, Amy Stewart, it has been such a pleasure talking with you. Welcome to Milwaukee, and have a great time here.
All right. Well, thank you.
Amy Stewart is an award-winning author of 6 books on the natural world, including 3 New York Times bestsellers. Her most recent book is The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. It's published by Algonquin Books. She was in Milwaukee last spring to speak at the Great Lakes Distillery, and she spoke with us then. Well, we are on day 3 of our winter membership drive, and we are hoping to raise $650 this hour, a total overall goal for this membership drive of $160,000. The way you become a member is you call 414-227-3210. That's 414-227-3210. You can also go online to wuwm.com/give to make your contribution, become a member, or renew your membership. And Dan Harmon, our producer and technical director, is sitting with me today. And Dan, we have a really wonderful drawing.
Yeah, I was surprised when I first read this that we're doing something this cool. Not that
I know.
We're not cool, but what this is Dinner for Two in Chicago at celebrity chef Homaru Kantu's restaurant called Moto. This will feature 14 courses with wine pairings. And yes, I said 14 courses.
I know, I'm drooling.
Yeah, and a private Moto indoor farm tour, because I know that they grow their own food, a lot of it on site in Chicago, which is interesting, plus a private lab cooking class.
And the cooking class, actually, I have to say, yes, I would love to have those 14 courses, but the cooking class sounds the most interesting to me.
Hmm.
I have no idea how they make all of this high-end gastronomy, you
okay.
know? And so that would be most interesting. But maybe you're thinking, well, you know what? No, I want the 14 courses and the wine.
I want the 14 courses, absolutely.
So it's a perfect thing, you know, to think. And anyone who makes a contribution is automatically entered. You do not have to make a contribution. Of course, we hope that you do. But you simply go to the website, wuwm.com/give, and you'll be entered in there. You can also make that phone call. And Dan, what's the number?
It is 414-227-3210, 414-227-3210, or go to our website, wuwm.com/give.
You know, Dan, one of the things that's so great about working on this show is that we get to interview people like Amy Stewart about things that you think, I would never have thought about writing a book about plants and alcoholic drinks. But we've been doing it for millennia. And here's somebody who came back. And I have to say, the book also has recipes in it, too. So that was a lot of fun to find out. Just the range of topics that we cover on Lake Effect is astounding. And there's a number that our membership people pull together that I really didn't know, and that's how many interviews we all do a year.
Collectively, we do about 1,000 interviews a year.
And that's a lot.
That's a lot, isn't it? We don't really think about it It's probably best not to think about it working on a daily basis. But yeah, that's a lot of work that goes into bringing all those people into the studio.
Bringing people into the studio, telling all of those stories, having the wide range of topics that Lake Effect covers. And we know as a listener to Lake Effect that you value that. And that is something that you tune in for and that you want to hear what's going on both in your backyard, in the state, and around the world. So now's the time to become part of the equation and to say, yes, I support that. And here are my dollars to do it. 414-227-3210, WUWM.com. Dan, any last words?
Yeah, I just hope that whoever wins the tour to Chicago will maybe come back to Lake Effect or come on Lake Effect and tell us about it.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, yes, if you win that wonderful prize, you have to come back and tell us what it's like, and we'll do an interview. Again, the number 414-227-3210 or WUWM.com. Well, coming up next, Milwaukee has been reeling over the assault on MSO concertmaster Frank Almond and the theft of his priceless Stradivarius violin. Milwaukee-based violin maker and Lake Effect essayist Corinthia Klein reflects on what a loss like this means to all of us. That's coming up next when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Last Monday's assault on the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra's concertmaster Frank Almond and the theft of his one-of-a-kind violin, the Lipinski Stradivarius, has rocked Milwaukee and the rest of the world. The investigation, which includes the FBI and Interpol, as well as the Milwaukee Police Department, is ongoing. But so far, there's no sign of the missing instrument. Lake Effect essayist and violin maker Corinthia Klein says the loss affects us all.
I am shocked and saddened by the violent theft of Frank Almond's Stradivari. It's international news that the concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra was leaving a recent performance when he was attacked with a taser and his instrument was stolen. The Lipinski Stradivari, for insurance purposes, is worth millions, but its true value is beyond measure. It's a piece of history, and it's been stolen from all of us. Instruments made by Antonio Stradivari are prized by musicians and collectors. They are the standard by which all violins are judged. They have long lives, and their stories are intertwined with some of the greatest figures in music history. Many have names, and this one was named for Karol Lipinski, a Polish virtuoso from the first half of the 19th century. The Lipinski violin was built in 1715 during what is referred to as Stradivari's golden period. It's a stunning example of the violin maker's craft. Part of what makes working with violins interesting, however, is finding them good matches with players, and Frank Almond and the Lipinski were a superb fit. He was invested in this instrument in a profound manner. Not only did he use his tremendous skills to master what that violin could do, but he delved into its history and worked to share that with the world in a way that included all of us in his discoveries and love for this instrument. His remarkable project titled A Violin's Life is a history lesson wrapped in the magic of great music. Frank Almond has been in my violin shop a couple of times. The first time he had his violin with him, and he was kind enough to ask me if I'd like to hold it. I was not going to be presumptuous enough to ask to hold his violin, but I was thrilled beyond belief when he offered. He's a generous person with his time and talent, and he knew what it would mean to a violin maker like me to be able to examine such an exquisite instrument. I accepted it from his hands, trying to look appreciative while not letting on how ridiculously giddy I actually felt. It was beautiful, and it was a vaguely surreal sensation to read a label inside a violin in my shop that said Antonius Stradivarius and know it was real for a change. That's not an experience I will soon forget, and I only got to hold that instrument for a few moments. I can only begin to imagine how devastating this event is for Mr. Almond, for whom that instrument was the tool of his trade and a partner in creating music at the highest levels. He has been as good a steward of such a piece of history as one could ask, tending to it with care while using it to its best effect and sharing its beauty with our city and beyond. I'm relieved to hear Frank Almond is physically okay. I'm worried about the safety of the violin, and I am disheartened by what we have lost as a community. To remove that instrument's voice from public spaces robs us all. Instruments like the Lipinski Strad have long lives with fascinating stories. As interesting as this particular chapter has gotten, I just hope it has a happy ending.
SAS Corinthia Klein is a violin maker and the mother of three in Milwaukee. She and her husband, a veteran, run a neighborhood violin store called Corinthian Violins in Bayview. She performs on the viola with the Festival City Symphony and on mandola with the Milwaukee Mandolin Orchestra. Klein blogs at Corinthia's Quiet Corner. Last week, we kicked off a weekly segment called Islands of Milwaukee that seeks to connect and engage seniors living across the Milwaukee area with a question of the day. Well, here's the next installment.
The Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie from the Islands of Milwaukee. I have a question of the day. Would you like to hear it?
What do I treasure in my home and why?
I'm blind and I'm 86 years old. And they asked me the question and I said it was the Bible.
What I treasure in my home is my sitting room. Why? Because it's where I am and all my family photos are with me. So if anything happens in here, I will be looking at my family.
A treasure to me would be financial security. Enough money to meet my expenses.
I treasure my oil paintings that were painted by my uncle, Francisco Spaguzza, who was a very famous Wisconsin artist.
Most of all, family pictures. And a pair of sunglasses there are at least 50 years old. And third would be my dust bunnies, because I don't have any other kind of pets.
And can you tell me more about your sunglasses?
If you recall a gal on TV, Sally Jesse Raphael, well, she had these great big red ones. Well, mine aren't red. Mine are more subtle. But they're that same size. And now that I've aged considerably, they cover the bags underneath. So, you know. They served a purpose, not just for the aesthetic value at the beginning, but later years, cosmetic as well. You can't go wrong with that. Over and out. Thank you.
These are just a few of the treasures we received from older people all over Milwaukee. If you have a person in your life who might like to answer some of our questions of the day, we invite you to become an envoy for the Islands of Milwaukee and help us to imagine a more connected community as we age. We'll be back next week with a new question and lots of new answers. Thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands Hotline at 414-678-1653. You can also visit the islandsofmilwaukee.org website. Well, you can also participate in WUWM's winter membership drive by becoming a member or renewing your membership today by calling 414-227-3210 or going to wuwm.com/give. I'm Bonnie North, joined by Dan Harmon in the studio for one last push to raise that $650 for this hour.
Yeah, earlier I gave some stats. I guess today I am the station statistician. Say that three times. So I would just like to give a few more facts about the station. These are statistics from the past year of the station. So, for example, we have over 100,000 listeners per week. So that's maybe something you don't know. That's quite a few. And last year, we had 1.5 million page views on our website.
That's really big.
Yeah.
I mean, and then, of course, that's coming. The website has become so much more important than it ever was in the last year or two. And we've put a lot of resources into making it better.
Yeah. Let me just rattle off a few more.
Sure.
Our news department produced 393 news reports. News and Lake Effect produced 12 series. The news department produced 69 national reports. And we received 22 awards.
And we're looking to get more this year.
I certainly hope so.
We certainly hope so. So this is, you know, it's one of those things we don't get to toot our own horn very often. And so this is a chance for us to tell you, you know you listen every day, but maybe you don't know that there are that many other listeners or that we have that many awards or that we're producing that much content. And so we hope that that has motivated you to become part of the equation this time and to become a member or to become a renewing member of WUWM. Dan, thanks so much for sitting in with me today. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today and listening to Lake Effect. Be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Again, that number to call is 414-227-3210 or go to the website wuwm.com. And thanks so much.